I wish I would have slowed down a bit more to appreciate all of the levels that I achieved, because there was definitely a set of years, you know, perhaps decades in my professional career that I was just moving so quick, both being pulled and pushing myself, that I was achieving success, but I wasn't, because I wasn't feeling it. I was just working harder to get to that next level.
You are a driven international professional or manager, have achieved quite a bit already, but are asking yourself from time to time, what do I really want? How do I want to work and live? Then this is your podcast. I'm Gina Friedrich, career and life coach for people who want to actively shape their future. Every second Thursday, I release interviews for you with inspiring, successful, as well as renowned international personalities from the world of business, NGO, and sports. They all will share with you what these questions mean to them, how they handled obstacles in their lives, and shaped their journey to where they are today. You are curious and don't want to miss anything? Sign up for this podcast right here. And now, let yourself be inspired on your very personal journey towards the future that you wish for. Hello and welcome to episode 39 of this podcast. You'll now get to know the man behind these words, Jerome Nadel, who lives in California. He is an internationally experienced marketing executive with general management background who holds an advanced degree in psychology. Jerome is the president of the CMOs Club San Francisco chapter and a board member of the Silicon Valley Executive Network, also known as SVEN. As he also is a passionate and quite successful cyclist, he shares motivating insights on his philosophy, which equally hold true and are of great value in today's business world. He talks about his last successfully closed deal before accepting a package and leaving the company to slow down and travel the world and enjoy the cycling season, which was right at the point of the COVID-19 virus spread. What this situation now enables him to reflect on, to appreciate, and what has helped him along the way, you will hear in this interview. We also talk about control, revealing personality tests, mindfulness, and improved management approaches. Parts of these insights are his guiding principles of lead with love, don't compare, and give more than you take. If you want to know the story behind that, and if he followed a plan that brought him to where he is today, then just stay tuned. Welcome, Jerome, and thanks for spending your time with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Gina.
And I'm happy that we have made it after facing some struggles with the 16 hours of time difference between California and Japan, where I am right now. So we made it.
We have, you know, sort of on opposite ends of a very connected world, you know, as we discussed in preamble to this. These are unprecedented and remarkable times.
True. And now we have the chance to get to know you a bit better here throughout this interview. And I would like to start with a question that you said you have listened to a couple of episodes already. So you might know that question. If I would be asking a close friend of yours, who is Jerome Nadel? What would he or she tell us?
That would depend on the friend that you asked. Because, and not purposefully, but something that I accept and almost enjoy. You know, I have different paths. There could be the professional path where my colleagues would, you know, describe me probably as somebody who's a bit quirky, creative, passionate, driven. But then in another genre, you could speak with the cyclists that I ride and race with, mm-hmm. and they would have a different view. So I've, you know, 58 this year, I've not really grown up. I'm still a very active racing athlete, and that's a significant part of my life as well. And, you know, I think the folks that I work with and the folks that I ride with have very little overlap, and neither side would sort of appreciate or imagine what I do in each of these dimensions, you know. And then of course there would be those in my personal circles and how they would describe me. And, you know, in this Venn diagram, I think there would be an overlap probably that, you know, he is passionate about what he does. You know, I was going to sort of share some of these dad-isms with you later, but, you know, I have sort of a set of belief pillars. Things like lead with love and give more than you take, and and don't compare or don't transact. And I think that that folks would see that in me, and they would use those as descriptors as well.
Thanks for this introduction. And you've just mentioned there, you would actually say there are different paths that are part of your life. And I, of course, could only look at your professional path so far. And that looks quite colorful and impressive, I have to say. Jerome, if there would be a movie about your life, what would the title be?
Wow. you know, I guess I would maybe not create a new title, but pick a title of a movie that was inspiring to me, and it's got a great moniker titled Captain Fantastic, a sort of indie film of a father who was raising his kids in the Northwest and sort of struggling with the way of living that felt more basic and inclusive versus where he saw society going. And there were really different dimensions of him, but his relationship with his kids, how he saw society, you know, the inherent good and passion that was shown was inspiring. And that's a great title too. So I guess maybe we would take that.
Yeah, what a nice title. Giving that title, I was just thinking that when I asked you to be part of this podcast series, when you were hearing the leading question of this podcast, like, what is my path and what do I really want? What was your first thought?
It was a provocative question because, you know, I'm at a very interesting inflection point in my career and life, actually. I've had a series of successes and, you know, I feel at least professionally I've been pulled from one opportunity to the next. And I came to a point working for my last employer, Rambus, a publicly held semiconductor supplier, where I went beyond my chief marketing officer role to be the general manager of a division that was actually based in Europe, Rotterdam and East Kilbride outside of Glasgow, Scotland. Mm-hmm. So I was going back and forth quite a bit. And, you know, the dynamics of Scotland and the Netherlands are not exactly identical either. For a set of reasons, the board felt that we should divest that asset and asked me to lead the sale of that. And we went to a successful completion of that process at the end of last year, where I sold the division to Visa. And with that,
congrats.
I had the opportunity. Thank you. And it was good for everybody. It was good for the team. It was good for Visa. It was good for Rambus. And, you know, I'd like to speak at some point to the dynamics of the best sort of deals where it's absolutely a win-win the whole way around. Mm-hmm. And I felt it was. And with that, the board had benevolently offered a package if I was interested. And I opted to take it. And at first I entertained, you know, I'll be 58 this year, the notion of retirement, still being connected as to accelerators and mentoring and advisory board posts. But just, you know, we spoke a bit before about travel. I just came back from 22 days in Africa. And I'd like to continue to see more of the world, but not, you know, jumping into fluorescent lights for meetings, but, you know, really being immersed in the experience of travel. In any event, I elected to take that package and left. And that was right at the point coming up to COVID-19, you know, because the end of my tenure was the beginning of February. And I had planned, at least in the spirit of sabbatical, that I would take 6 months to enjoy and appreciate what had happened and you know, really slow down. And I felt I was living life at a high speed, and slowing down and appreciating everything would be a perfect reset to enable myself to dig deep and determine what I wanted to do next. Mm-hmm. And, you know, suddenly for things beyond any of our control, everything changed. And the feeling of reward and being settled has been, you know, a bit disrupted by the dynamics of the world, which provides other opportunity, you know, the ability to slow down and move at the pace of the world and reflect on where I am. And that's a bit of what's going on for me right now. You know, if if things were normal, we're right in the beginning of the center of the cycling season. And, you know, I do, crazy as it sounds, I do between 40 and 50 races per season, per year. I travel to do these. I'm, you know, 18,000 kilometers a year on the bike. And I love this with passion. And it was taken away, you know, the around the world, racing as well as everything else has stopped. The camaraderie of going out and, you know, training with my teammates and friends, and the opportunity to separate myself from that work stream, you know, and that professional side. So things got both sort of taken away a bit and conflated, and, you know, but also provide an opportunity to, again, slow down to reflect and appreciate. And that's what I'm working on right now, you know, as much as anything.
Thanks for sharing that very personal view on how you actually experienced the situation. And it's a very challenging time for everyone, especially in your situation where it was like the moment to start something new, and now everything, like someone has pressed the hold button. I would be curious to know what is actually helping you. If you say like creating this momentum of slowing down, how do you manage to do that? Is there something that you might be able to share with the listeners?
Well, this is remarkably revealing, actually. You know, to aid in that, I enlisted an executive coach, a personal coach, and took the Enneagram test. And, you know, this is a measure of 9 different traits or archetypes that stay with you, that are not state-based, but, you know, are more long-term. And you are primarily one of these 9 types. And what was remarkable for me, you know, the title given for the type that I align with, mm-hmm. is called active controller.
Oh.
And when I first read that label, you know, I found it negative and pejorative. And I said, oh, goodness. And, you know, you look around the wheel, and of course, all of these Myers-Briggs and whatever test you take, you know, has positive and negative of each of these. But I try to then understand. And within that, you can be, you know, really anchored on any of these, or you could be what they call within this this testing methodology, more integrated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess fortunately I'm considered highly integrated, but an active controller. And I challenged myself and said, you know, how did I become that? And, you know, the positive side of this, as you might imagine, is things get done. You move forward, and, you know, the successful people can be that. But, you know, you don't want to be knocking folks out of the way to get there. I don't believe in that at all. And so I was sort of fighting on this notion. But then I reflected, and I'm coming to your question, on, you know, why do I feel like I need control? And, you know, in the determinism versus free will, you know, the ability to affect our place in the world and the like, I think there have been episodes in my life where I did feel that it was incumbent on me to be able to create, you know, the stability that I would be standing on. And I don't need to go, you know, with the full audience you have into all of that. But it's been an opportunity to go backwards and ask, you know, what was destabilizing that required a compensation to be more stable? And obviously there were elements. Yeah, definitely. I could go in from my childhood to points through my life that there are these episodes, you know, that you could call aha moments that impacted me to feel that just taking control and doing, and, you know, part of the athlete in me, you know, one thing that's common across sport is, I use a metaphor with my kids of fast and fit. And, you know, fast is what we're born with. You could be intellectual, creative, athletic, whatever that is. And that's the level that you were given. But then fit is how you respect it. And, you know, hopefully for all of us in life, we have a fast and we find it and respect it with our fit. And I think elite athletes really respect their fast. because it's not always, no pun intended, the fastest one who wins. It's the one who's fit on top of their fast. And I think athletes learn the power of habit and repetition. And when all else fails, they're stabilized by the ability to just go and do it again. And, you know, that can be treadmill-like. And definitely it's a way to move you ahead. And it's really hard to break that habit. Again, another dynamic of this time, we are out of control. Mm. You know, this is bigger than us. So we need to sit in the back seat and embrace what's going on, which is a form of control in itself, controlling yourself, you know, to accept that situation. And I think at times in my life, you know, I've been the guy who could carry things through, the provocateur, you know, a bit of the contrarian to say we can get there. And fortunately, I've been successful at that. But sometimes it is dragging folks to that same endpoint who didn't necessarily want to go. And I'm finding at this point in my life, I'm just more observant of that behavior. And again, I won't judge it or call it good or bad because it is what it is. But I think it's important, you know, for us as human beings to just be mindful of who we are, celebrate that, but, you know, also understand that for every good, there's something less good in how we are.
Yeah, and the way we look at it is always a choice we have, right? We choose the angle, the perspective that we take. That's actually, yeah, a gift as soon as you are aware of that.
Absolutely. You know, I there's another sort of continuum that I speak to a lot and I really believe in. And it's so simple. And it's just the notion of scarcity at one end to abundance at the other. And, you know, that could be very literal. The notion of scarcity you don't have and the behaviors that surround scarcity are, you know, let me hold, let me transact, let me be more conservative, let me reserve. And the other end of that, and again, it could be to the point of naivete, is, you know, there is abundance. There's unending opportunity. There are green pastures. The oasis does exist. You know, the lean startup leap of faith. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that one be anchored at one end or the other and that there are, you know, there are truths when there is no food, there is no food. But I think psychologically, and you see organizations, you know, organizations at an executive level that start coming to the end of a quarter that they're concerned about can acknowledge the concern of meeting, you know, whatever objective that they've set. From a guidance perspective, earnings per share, whatever it be, and then start acting in a way that compounds that scarcity. And, you know, the other side of that is thinking more opportunistically, more strategically, more long-term. And that's abundant. And I think we all walk around on this line between scarcity and abundance. And if we're mindful of that and push ourselves towards abundance, we find that not only for ourselves, but for those around us, we can do more. And it's not competition-based. It's not transaction-based. Everybody moves together. And, you know, wacky as I am within our executive team, not only in my last employer, but in those that tolerated me before, you know, I think these sorts of things to share is look at how we're acting. You know, of course, we need to be mindful of the P&L, but we're just limiting our thinking and the actions that follow because we're falling back to that scarcity end over here. You know, what if we just put on different lenses and saw the opportunity? Again, of course, we need to be cognizant of our spend against revenue, but let's look at it another way. I'm long-winded, but let me extend that even. You know, when I think of racing, if you are in an elite level of racing and you spend your energy competing against your quote competitors, mm-hmm. you're robbing yourself of the energy to permission yourself forward. And if you go into that in a more abundant mindset of I'm just going to move myself forward and not make it like I'm comparing or competing directly against the others in the race, mm-hmm. you take your own breaks off and you perform at your best level, which enables you magically to move mm-hmm. through, you know, the chaos of the peloton safely and come at the front in the sprint. It's a brilliant thing. Anyway, that was a bit long-winded.
And this, again, needs the awareness and the mindfulness to do so. That was very inspiring. You were now already giving us some more insights in your path that brought you to where you are today. And I was just thinking, maybe you could share with us how you actually got around your field of expertise. I don't know if there was a plan that you followed.
Pretty circuitous. I started going back to university. You know, again, I was sort of an athlete who had a scholarship to school and had a business degree in mind. And then I took some courses in philosophy and psychology and just, you know, went from I can do this to I love this. And from undergraduate, went into graduate school in a psychology program, but it was what was called industrial organizational psychology. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the notion would be that it's more business related, and the industrial side is how do I select people? How do I do performance management? And the organizational side, which was more interesting to me, is, you know, how do people get along in groups and what are the dynamics of an effective group? I am halfway through I was on a PhD track, but I left for my first job before completing my dissertation. But I completed the thesis work, which was in the industrial organizational side, I went into back then what was called applied experimental, much more esoteric, perception, cognition. And I really loved that, but I realized that it was arguably going further from, you know, a professional path. And I thought I might go into academia. Mm-hmm. Noam Chomsky and psycholinguistics is interesting because what we call things reflects how we think about them. So there wasn't human factors back then, or now everybody talks about user experience. You know, that was a name that really came about in the new millennium where, you know, what we spoke about at first was human factors, which would be more like a man-machine interface. You know, how do I design systems so people can be performant? And then it was usability. And, you know, you're in sort of the beginning of the internet. And how could people complete tasks effectively? How could they, you know, convert in a shopping cart, again, at the beginning of online? And then the notion of, you know, experience and you know, love and aesthetic around the value of user experience. And I don't know that I saw it, but I sort of felt early on that, if you will, usability or user-centered design and marketing were very much the same. And I was having these being pulled to jobs where I would be more of a classical practitioner of user-centered design thinking. And then I would go cross the line and be asked to be in a marketing capacity. And I sort of rationalized that, saying, you know, it's not a sellout to be in marketing, but the power of story holds true in both. You know, in user-centered and design think methodologies, in agile sprints, you know, you begin with the user story, and the narrative that you build helps you imagine and construct the way the thing should be built, you know, be it soft or physical. And in marketing, you know, often we see that as being downstream, where the marketeer receives something and says, let me build a story that would help people, you know, understand, appreciate, desire, you know, and ultimately buy. And if those stories were combined, where the story that the marketer uses is in line with the stories that help create the thing, you know, it would be authentic and simple. And that has been a theme for me and sort of held on to a notion of design-led marketing. So as a marketer, which I evolved to more senior roles through time, it was important to be connected to have ownership of product marketing, to be connected to the beginning of requirements definition and the stories and methodologies that support that. And, you know, as a pure marketer, to make sure that it wasn't just, you know, downstream inauthentic promotion, but you were really connected to that thing is they say when you cook with love, people can taste it. Mm-hmm. You know, and the marketer can't be effective if they don't love the food they cooked. So that's another thing that I think is important. You know, especially in the United States, we try to track kids into a discipline, you know, almost robotically, that I'm going to be a this or a that. And the esprit of the sort of Renaissance thinker, you know, that is more transversal, I think is really important. And you know, the irony is the higher up the hierarchy you go, the more you get to be and the more you're reinforced for thinking transversally, thinking laterally. And you know, I think if organizations could think laterally from the top to the bottom, of course you have to have accountability, you know, for all of the cogs on the gear. But that way of thinking, you know, from beginning to end in an interdisciplinary way, teams that are you know, sideways, not vertical, is important. And so, you know, how have I gotten to where I am? I really crossed these paths. And so at the beginning, the word marketing felt sort of like salesman, but it's not. Marketing is enormous. The space, the canvas is huge, and it's as big as the marketer will make it. There's a worldwide entity called the CMO Club. There's about 650 CMOs worldwide, and I'm the president of the Silicon Valley San Francisco chapter, you know, one of the leading chapters. And I argue that to folks that, you know, let's all take this job and make it as big as it can be. When I was asked recently to be a general manager, you know, general managers make more in comp than chief marketing officers. And I said, you know, I'll supplement what I'm doing and do that, but I'm not going to turn, you know, the added compensation down. But why is a general manager worth more than a CMO? And, you know, the notion is that you're responsible for the P&L. But I mean, our society is, you know, why is a teacher paid less than a doctor? What makes one thing more valuable than another? Mm-hmm. So I think if we all were transversal, we'd have more appreciation for the value that, you know, everybody plays in the team and society at large.
And all this still requires decisions sometimes, and some of them might have been very hard. I don't know if there's the hardest decision that you would actually, that you could pick, that you had to make throughout this journey that you could share with us.
Probably multiple times of the same thing. I think any time that we think about doing something else, it's always hard to let go of the branch that we're on. And I think if I could go back in time, I was a bit of a laggard in that way. I was content where I was, and it took a lot of energy to break the elastic to get me to go to the other side. And, you know, I've worked internationally. You know, again, I spoke most recently about running these groups that were Europe-based, but I lived in France twice. My mom's French, and I do have the benefit of a French passport and dual citizenship. But I, you know, one time left the U.S. and went to the south of France, sold a company to a French-based company, and that was a very different lifestyle, a great opportunity. And then I came back to the U.S. and then went back again for another opportunity. So, mm-hmm. you know, these decisions of letting go what I know to try something new, I you know, the word étranger in French is, it has more connotation than just a stranger. You know, it's that things work different than what you know. And, you know, as you're now in Japan and, you know, are one who loves to travel, you talked about already going around the world once and doing it again. It's so, such a learning opportunity to expose yourself to environments where you don't know how things work. You know, and on the other hand, in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley, you know, there's a notion of don't stay at a job too long because you get stale. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's push and pull on both sides, because we could live in a world where we're never satisfied with what we have and everything is a stepping stone to the next. and you know, you never have that moment of appreciation or contentment. But as well, you can stay stuck, you know, with your eyes closed to the opportunities of the world. So, you know, reflecting back, I think these decisions have been hard to say, will I take it and go? And I'm really, you know, even with everything I shared earlier of this sort of awkward time to, you know, get ready to retire, to step away with, you know, the unimaginable set of months we've had over here, I don't regret it at all. I think it was really a bold move for me to just jump away and say, I don't want to jump into something else full time right now. I want to to take this time, you know, really cutting the cord, if you will. So big decision, no regret.
I can only imagine. And in regards to these decisions, or I mean, I would, as you said, you don't regret anything. But could you say what percentage of key decisions in general were taken following your gut feel?
You know, that's a complex question, because I think for myself, I over-rationalize. So I, you know, in the sort of Malcolm Gladwellian blink, I can have a gut, but then I spend a lot of cerebral energy around that, debating on that gut. So probably most of them only reinforce that gut feel, but they're hyper-rationalized along the way. You know, and I'm just trying to create an argument of the way I felt is that right thing. But, you know, just transparently and honestly, I, you know, I could make quick decisions, but I it's not like, hey, I just had a hunch, let's just, you know, run in this direction over here. I can feel it, but then I layer that with sort of logic, rationale.
But what helps you then to take, yeah, important big decisions like the one you were just sharing with us?
You know, some of these decisions are going to be just good business, good being a practitioner of life, and, you know, realizing that there, you know, there's a bigger opportunity or where I am, you know, at any sort of metric based way. But others, and this was more of a life fulfillment thing. And you know, I'd say for me, when I was younger and earlier in my career, I was running so fast, I couldn't really feel what was around me. So it was just a bit of a blur. You know, when I, we had sold our startup to a large French telecom supplier in the south of France, beautiful lifestyle down there, and moved to the south of France in 2000. And maybe with more personal detail than needed, but it's part of the story. That sort of terminated a 15-year marriage with my ex-wife. She was unhappy in the south of France, wanted to come back to the U.S. And I, of course, couldn't stay there. I had two kids. And as it turned out, I was going to go back. And I didn't know at the point, but we agreed I would have full custody of my kids, which was another major life decision that was made easy because that was sort of pushed for in that way. And, you know, I stepped back professionally and learned so much from the two of them and what's really important in life. But as I was getting ready to leave, there was a set of months that I was over there alone and the company was saying, you know, stay on. I had an important role and the like. And of course, I was riding my bike. And when I was the beautiful Mediterranean village of Bandol, where I lived, had a viewport, an old port. And at the end of my ride, I'm rolling back to the house and something sort of compelled me to go to the water. And I took my left foot out and put it down and just sat there for a moment. And, you know, literally my life was so high speed. It was, you know, I can get out of my work clothes, get on my bike, get my riding, get in the shower, jump to my next thing as fast as anybody. And that was a level of actioning for me to say, I'm going to do this every day until I leave. In every ride, I'm going to take this moment and just appreciate this ride. And it's just a different orientation, you know, in that way to just take this and appreciate, you know, the good of what you're doing. So that for folks like me, doesn't come easy. I think you've got to work that, you know, that muscle, that way of thinking to say, I am going to slow down and appreciate this. And I found through time that, you know, reactors like me can be so quick and so proficient, but had they thought on their response to an email overnight, they would come back with a better reply than firing back a reply that wasn't well thought through. And if anything, I have slowed down through time, which I think has helped.
Yeah, interesting learnings that you've just shared with us. Thanks a lot. So looking back, it seems like the way you dealt with big decisions led to success. What does the word success mean to you, Jerome?
That's a great question. You know, that success can be defined by some external measure, you know, or internal. Success is a feeling. You know, I spoke a little bit before about the coaching that I'm working on now, and we talked about, you know, three dimensions over here. You know, the doing dimension, the thinking dimension, and the feeling dimension. And I think I conflate thinking and feeling. And I've been spending more energy on just being aware of, you know, the fact that they are different. Thinking is logical, feeling is emotional. And I think success is a feeling. And success feels like the result of your applied effort. It's satisfying. It shows for you that you've done good with something. So success could be immeasurable. It could just be an emotion that you have of something that you did that was good. Success can be something that others could see. You know, but success is not the amount of money that you've made or the number of races that you've won. Because you could be more successful making less or more successful not winning, but having ridden, you know, your full race, being an animator, riding like a champion. So I think I define success as that, you know, wonderful feeling of good where you did your best and you got a positive result out of that. You know, I know it's a bit of an ambiguous, amorphous definition, but that's the truth of feelings and emotions. They're, you know, constructs that we try to define, and it's that feel good. And if you don't, you know, if you don't give yourself time to appreciate, you're never going to feel success. You're going to continue to win trophies. You're going to continue to have, you know, as we say in the U.S., big W-2s. You're going to make a lot of money. You're going to have a big home. You're going to have fancy cars. But unless you feel, you take time to say, you know, I'm glad about what I've done, and it feels good, then you're really not allowing yourself to experience success.
And as you've just said, we give, we construct these things, these words, right? We give this word a meaning. And did this definition change throughout your life and after getting to a top management position?
I think so. I think when I think in general, when we're younger, when we, you know, especially those who have, you know, ambition, if you will. I mean, that's, I don't know if that's the right term, but regardless, if you're an artist, if you're, you know, an academic, if you're an entrepreneur, again, I'd say when we're running so fast to achieve, it's so gamified that there's never going to be a level that feels like you've gotten there. So, you know, if I could go back in time, I wish I would have slowed down a bit more to appreciate all of the levels that I achieved, because there was definitely a set of years, you know, perhaps decades in my professional career that I was just moving so quick, both being pulled and pushing myself, that I was achieving success, but I wasn't, because I wasn't feeling it. I was just working harder to get to that next level. So I wasn't getting the fulfillment of success. You know, again, you've got to allow yourself to feel that.
Yeah, so that's the way you celebrate a success then?
Yeah, I think if we do, I think if we, and you know, this is a remarkable opportunity, if you will, to just, although the dynamics of world economies and the like are challenged, there's anxiety, but I think if, you know, we individually and collectively reflected on, you know, our good fortune, especially I'm sure the listeners of your podcasts, you know, we could be appreciative. Being appreciative, thinking in an abundant way is a state of mind. And I've certainly, you know, not perfected that art, but I think the more aware we are of that, the closer we get to, you know, being able to appreciate success and therefore being successful.
I would like to quickly go back to something that you've mentioned before, which was this lead with love dadism that is, yeah, that is kind of being a guiding pillar in your life. Maybe there's, yeah, there's a story behind this that you would like to share.
There is a story. You know, it's funny. I think earlier in life, I had sort of belief pillars, if you will, you know, that established sort of rules of engagement. And having kids, you know, is a great audience because they're stuck with you, that you can say these things. So my kids, even at early ages, sarcastically would call these dadisms. And, you know, the probably most prominent one among the three most prominent was lead with love. And, you know, when you have siblings, a son and a daughter, you know, a girl and a boy at each other, we would just talk about interfacing with the world in a way where you're leading first with positivity. And, you know, argued when we come into any situation at any level, in any dynamic, leading with love, that that changes the chemistry of everyone around you. You know, another one to them, and I'll come back to lead with love and the story behind that, was give more than you take. And, you know, if we just sort of existentially look at each situation and say, of course, we don't want to be taken advantage of, but that notion of I'm going to give my most and I don't have expectation out of my actions to immediately get reward, you know, it puts us in a more giving way. And the final one that they heard a lot was don't compare. And it's so easy for us in life to judge ourselves by looking around, you know, but when we do that, we become very transactional. And again, our actions are have expectation around them that this is going to do something for me. So these sorts of dadisms have actually become more believable for me through time. You know, they started out as words to help my kids, you know, have guiding principles, and they reflected what I believe. But again, they've only become more distilled, more codified, more believable for me than ever. About 3 years ago, long story short, back in 2000, we got a puppy from my daughter. She grew up somehow through all of this. I got that dog. That dog lived in France twice. He was the king, Le Roi. He had died about 5 years ago. My daughter, who loves animals, has a horse, has been an office manager at veterinary clinics and the like, said, Dad, you need another dog. And Ethan, my son, and I found a breeder. They were both on the East Coast. We're going to pick this dog up and bring it to you. And it was remarkable for me to feel, you know, that they were making this physical but sort of metaphorical journey together to do something for me. And they were going to bring, you know, this new puppy into my life driving cross country, which would be great for the two of them to come together. They arrive in California with little Ellie. We like Veuve Clicquot, and there's a story about Eleanor, and because her middle name is Clicquot. Anyway, so they bring little Ellie, and my daughter was about to be married in a set of months. And she said, Dad, go ahead and write down lead with love in your horrific handwriting. And I wrote it down thinking that it was going to be something connected to the wedding. it turned out I was in the office that day. I come back and they're both super excited. And they said, Ted, look at what we did. We went to Santa Cruz and we both got this tattoo. And they pulled up their shirts, and on the side of their torso, my son larger, my daughter smaller, and they're beautiful kids, have these tattoos in my handwriting,
Read
with Love. So somehow I impressed this upon them. I never thought it would be truly inscribed, but, you know, again, they're like, what do you think? And it was mixed emotion because I'm not big on tats. But I thought, you know, I sort of cried that message to them, you know, was so compelling that they would actually carry that around with them.
Wow.
You know, truly physically on their body. So, and, you know, these sorts of things, these simple guiding principles are just helpful for us to reflect on. And, you know, again, one more time, far from perfect, but the more I think about, the more any of us think about them, you know, the better we can do at them. There is abundance, there's scarcity too, but, you know, if we want to be on the abundant side of that continuum, we can. If we permission ourselves, good things happen.
We choose.
If we lead with love, we change chemistry. We choose how we want to be as we interface with the world, for sure.
Yeah, and I think this was super inspiring for everyone listening. Thank you very much for also sharing this personal story with us. And it's so true. So these three statements, they will definitely end up in the show notes. You were mentioning, like, if you would be going back in time, you would do things differently. And I was just wondering if there's also a question that you wish you had asked yourself or a mentor earlier in life.
I would just probably, you know, and I heard repeatedly, I remember the head of HR at the French company that had acquired us in the south of France, you know, and he said to me, Jérôme, you are like a Le Mans car. You can go as fast as anybody. But in Provence, you need a cat to climb the mountains. Everybody was telling me to slow down, and I couldn't hear it. You know, I just thought faster, more was better. Mm-hmm. So I wish I had the insight then, you know, perhaps to just listen, if not ask. And that's probably what I, you know, again, no regrets, but just looking back in time saying, boy, I probably would have been more successful by the definition that we discussed, you know, if I had slowed down to appreciate everything I had along this journey, because, you know, as we know, it's not about the destination, because I don't know that there is one.
Jérôme, it was amazing just listening to you. There was a smile on my face most of the time, and I really appreciate that you were so openly taking us into different stages and experiences of your life. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a great conversation. Thank you. And I really appreciate the time.
Jérôme, all the best, and you and your family, stay healthy and take care.
You're great. My pleasure. Ciao, ciao.
Ciao. Did you like this episode? Yay. Sign up for this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Android Podcasts, Deezer, or on your individual podcast player. Thanks for listening and spending your time with me today. Ciao.